Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are tackling a subject of immense importance, one where quick, precise knowledge can literally change a person's life. We're talking about identifying the physical signs of elder abuse and neglect. We've taken a comprehensive professional desk guide, and really, we've distilled it into actionable, specific knowledge for you. This isn't just about general awareness. It's about mastering the visible indicators, the medical terms, and the immediate steps you absolutely must take. Okay, let's unpack this.
That's the critical mission right there. We're moving beyond the basics to focus on the specific physical signs, the indicators that professionals rely on, and we're pairing them with the precise medical language and, most importantly, the action steps. The goal is for you to gain thorough and quick knowledge of these red flags. But before we dive into any of the specifics, the foundation for all of this is caution. If you ever encounter a situation where you are unsure if abuse or neglect is present, you have to consult your supervisor or a qualified healthcare professional immediately.
Okay, so let's begin with the most common sign bruising. I mean, bruises are incredibly common in older adults, just due to aging skin and thinner capillaries. So if a bruise is present, what are the, say, three key characteristics that elevate it from a simple accident to a high suspicion of abuse?
Okay, so the first indicator is time. Abusive bruising often appears in multiple stages of healing at the same time. You might see a fresh, purple bruise right next to a yellowing older one. That tells a story of repeated injury.
Right, not just a one-off incident.
Exactly. The second is location. Abusive bruises are frequently found in multiple, often illogical parts of the body. And the third, which is maybe the most telling, is the hidden location. So areas not typically injured in an accidental fall, we're talking the soles of the feet, the torso, the inner thighs, and generally abusive bruises are also just bigger, significantly larger than minor accidental scrapes.
And this is all made so much more complex by medication, isn't it? So many of the clients we work with are on blood thinners, warfarin, aspirin, even just a lot of ibuprofen. I mean, that drastically increases bleeding. Does that mean we have to rely even more heavily on those location and staging clues?
Absolutely. The presence of blood thinners complicates everything. It makes the location and the pattern of the injury the gold standard for your assessment, which is also why we need to use precise language. When you report this, you need to sound like the expert you are. The simple term for a bruise is ecchymosis. Now, if the injury involves blunt force and you see swelling, redness, stiffness, and bruising, that's a contusion. That's a much bigger injury.
Okay, so if I'm documenting, ecchymosis is just a flat, simple discoloration. But a contusion implies there was significant, noticeable trauma.
Precisely. And if that collection of blood is even deeper, if it forms a lump under the skin you can actually feel, that's when you document it as a hematoma. Now, one thing to be careful about, to avoid confusion, is something called senile purpura. This is that purplish, splotchy bruising you often see on the back of the hands and forearms of older adults. It's from minor everyday bumps. That's just a normal aging effect, so you don't want to confuse it with abuse.
Okay, this is where it gets really interesting for me. Let's talk about pattern injury. Because this seems to bypass all that ambiguity of thin skin and medication, what exactly defines a pattern injury?
A pattern injury is when the shape of the object used to cause harm is visibly imprinted on the client's skin. It could appear as a bruise, a burn, or a welt. It is, like you said, just irrefutable visual evidence.
And the examples in the sources are, they're so disturbing in how specific they are. Bruising around the neck that matches the pressure of a hand, or these perfectly circular small burns that match the end of a cigarette. You're talking about welts that look like the hook of a coat hanger or even the lines of a belt buckle.
And that specificity is so crucial for documentation. It lets you connect the injury directly to a mechanism. If you see those clear parallel lines or distinct geometric shapes, you know immediately this was not an accidental fall onto a piece of furniture.
That detail. It leads us perfectly into the next critical area. Fractures. Broken bones. In a population that's already prone to falling, how do we distinguish an accidental break from a suspicious one?
Again, we look at location. Accidental fractures in older adults, they almost always happen in sites related to falls. So they're trying to break their fall, right? So you'll see breaks in the hip, the wrists, or sometimes compression fractures in the vertebrae of the spine. So if you find fractures in other areas like the shoulders, arms, or the skull, you have to start considering abuse.
And what should you be looking for physically in terms of how it presents?
Well, beyond any obvious deformity, fractured ribs are extremely telling. The client will be in immense pain, they won't be able to take a deep breath, and you'll see bruising over the rib cage. But the most critical indicator, the one you have to flag as possible physical abuse, is the spiral fracture.
Can you explain that a bit more, the mechanism of a spiral fracture?
Yeah. So unlike a straight break from an impact, a spiral fracture is caused by a twisting force being applied to a limb. The break actually travels diagonally around the bone. In an older adult, unless they were in, say, a major car crash or fell from a huge height, which would have other massive injuries, a spiral fracture is almost always a sign of physical abuse. It's the result of someone forcefully twisting an arm or a leg, and that mandates an immediate investigation.
Okay, let's transition now to high-risk trauma, specifically involving the head. Given how vulnerable the brain is, we need to understand the mechanics of an injury like coup and contre-coup.
Right. Think of the brain like a soft gelatin suspended inside the hard, bony skull. When there's a significant blunt force, the brain strikes the inner wall of the skull at that point of impact. That's the coup. But then momentum causes the brain to rebound and slam into the opposite side of the skull. That's the contre-coup. So you have damage at the initial site and on the opposite side.
And this kind of trauma is what often leads to a subdural hematoma, right? Bleeding on the brain, which is incredibly dangerous.
Exactly. Subdural hematomas are essentially silent killers. The brain bleeding can increase pressure very slowly, leading to a delayed onset of symptoms, maybe a concussion, maybe loss of consciousness. And because the brain space in older adults has shrunk a little bit, the bleeding can sometimes be accommodated at first, only to cause a major crisis hours or even days later.
Are there external signs of a skull fracture that should put us on immediate high alert?
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. The two most critical signs that point to a fracture at the base of the skull are the battle sign, which is bruising found specifically behind one or both ears and raccoon eyes, which appears two black eyes, but the bruising seems contained within the orbital bone, not from a direct hit to the face.
And the protocol here is non-negotiable, right?
Non-negotiable. All suspected head trauma, no matter how it happened, must be assessed by a medical professional immediately. The risk of permanent brain damage is just too high.
This is where we need to draw that absolute emergency line. What are the specific critical symptoms that mandate an immediate 911 call?
Yeah, we cannot wait for a doctor's appointment on these. The list is slurred speech, any weakness or numbness on one side of the face or body, any loss of consciousness, even a brief one. Also, a new onset of confusion that's way off their baseline, the client complaining of the worst headache ever, any clear liquid draining from the ears or nose, or seeing those bruises, both eyes or behind the ears. And critically, if the head trauma was unwitnessed, if you don't know how it happened or how severe it was, that is an automatic 911 trigger.
Let's move to strangulation. This is an injury that's often missed because the signs can be so fleeting. The sources advise us to use really clear language like choked or putting a hand around the neck during an assessment.
Yes, and we should even use hand gestures to clarify, to bypass any jargon. The physical signs are absolutely key here. Look for a hoarse voice, bruising to the face and neck, and if a rope or cord was used, you might see these thin lines called ligature marks. Also, look for what's called a sniffer posture, where the neck is a bit extended and the nose is raised up as the body is just desperately trying to get more oxygen.
And what about those tiny spots on the face?
Those are facial petechiae. They're small red or purple spots caused by capillaries bursting from the immense pressure when blood vessels in the neck are blocked. The urgency here is paramount. Even if the marks fade quickly, strangulation needs an immediate medical assessment. The internal damage can be severe, and any prolonged lack of oxygen dramatically increases the risk of brain death or stroke.
And finally, on this acute trauma, stab wounds. What's a common presentation that might indicate a struggle?
You want to look specifically for defensive wounds. These often appear on the inner parts of the wrists, forearms, or hands, which indicates the client was trying to shield their body during an assault. What's fascinating here is how signs of neglect, unlike acute trauma, are often chronic. They're insidious. They can be easily misattributed to just general poor health. Let's look at pressure ulcers. You might know them as decubitus ulcers or bed sores. Recognizing these is confirmation that a client was left in the same position for a long, long time without being turned.
And they occur in very specific, predictable locations, don't they?
They do, primarily over bony areas where skin is compressed against the surface. So, you know, the heels, the sacrum at the base of the spine, the hips, elbows, ears, even the back of the head. And crucially, they can also show up under medical devices. The bridge of the nose from oxygen tubing, on the lips from intubation, or on the arms where IVs have been placed.
Proper staging is so essential for documentation. What are the key distinctions we should know?
Well, they range from a stage one, which is intact skin with redness that doesn't blanch, meaning the redness doesn't disappear when you press on it, or it looks purplish and darker skin, all the way up to a stage four. And a stage four is where the injury has gone so deep it's reached muscle and maybe even bone. But the most alarming one might actually be the deep tissue injury, or DTI.
And why is DTI so concerning?
Because the skin on the surface is still intact, but the damage has already happened deep beneath. It often just looks like a maroon or a purple bruise or maybe a blood-filled blister. If you see this, you know that tissue death is already extensive under the surface, and you need rapid intervention to stop a catastrophic deterioration.
Okay, moving to burns. How do we differentiate between burns from abuse versus those that are from neglect?
Physical abuse burns are often patterned. They match the shape of the source. You know, the pattern from an iron, or the circular pattern of a cigarette. Intentional hot water burns are also really characteristic. They usually happen on both sides of the body, or they show these clear glove or sock lines where a limb was forced into scalding water and then pulled out.
And neglect burns?
Those usually result from an underlying condition. For instance, a client with advanced dementia might touch a hot radiator without understanding the danger. Or you see burns from a lack of sensation, which is common in things like peripheral neuropathy. You see it in diabetics or chronic alcoholics, where they injure themselves on a heat source and just don't feel it happening.
And regardless of the cause, large burns mean immediate escalation.
Absolutely. Large burns require emergency treatment. The risk of infection is incredibly high, the pain is extreme, and there's a very dangerous risk of dehydration and fluid loss that can lead to organ failure.
Let's quickly cover malnutrition and dehydration, which are such classic signs of chronic neglect.
Malnutrition presents visibly. You'll see marked weakness, wounds that just won't heal, and significant unexplained weight loss. Dehydration is signaled by dry skin and dry mucous membranes in the mouth. Both need an immediate assessment, especially dehydration, which can lead to fainting, falling, and dangerously low blood pressure.
And finally, medication abuse, which can be so easily masked as just managing an illness.
This is a really sophisticated form of control and abuse. Over-medication is used to sedate the client, right? To make them lethargic and easier to manage. Conversely, you have under-medication or just withholding essential medicine, maybe to save money or as a punishment, which causes chronic diseases like diabetes or heart failure to get worse fast, or it leaves a serious infection untreated.
And just a quick note on the signs of sexual abuse.
Yeah, you want to look for bruising on the inner thighs, recurring UTIs, or the presence of STIs in clients who are non-consenting or not sexually active. Those are clear indicators that require immediate reporting.
So, the physical signs tell us what happened, but the sources really stress these crucial non-physical behavioral clues that provide the context of how and why we should be suspicious. Let's start with caregiver clues.
The first major flag is non-compliance. You know, missing appointments, constantly getting medication doses wrong. But the most serious red flag is when the caregiver's explanation for an injury is just vague, or it keeps changing, or it simply doesn't match the injury you're looking at. If a caregiver says a massive hematoma is from bumping the coffee table, the story just doesn't line up. A delay in seeking care is also critical. But maybe the single most powerful clue is if the caregiver consistently refuses to allow the client to speak without them being present. That just screams isolation and control.
And what are the behavioral clues from the client themselves that we need to be vigilant for?
We have to monitor for any significant change from their established baseline behavior. Are they suddenly fearful when the alleged abuser comes in the room? Are they newly confused when they were lucid before? Look for physical signs of nervousness, sweating, wringing their hands, avoiding eye contact. They might immediately change the subject if you try to discuss an injury. Or even show a change in speech, like a new stutter or hesitancy. These subtle nonverbal cues often confirm the suspicion that a physical mark raises.
And these observations, they have to translate directly into action. So beyond those 911 triggers, what are the overall escalation tips we need to keep in mind, especially with fractures?
I mean, it comes down to this. Always trust your gut. If something feels wrong, escalate it. Talk to your supervisor. Talk to a professional. Specifically with orthopedic injuries, any suspected broken leg, especially a hip, needs urgent assessment because of the high risk of a fatal blood clot forming. We should also escalate if a client has a history of unexplained falls, a new difficulty walking, persistent pain in their hips or knees, or, and this is a classic sign, if you see one leg looks visibly shorter than the other, that points to a hip fracture.
And for documentation, if we can't get permission to take a picture, what are the practical tips to make that documentation really irrefutable?
The first rule is always try to take pictures. but you must get permission from the client or their proxy first. If you can't take pictures, you need highly specific detailed descriptions. Use a common item, like a quarter or a ruler, to measure and compare the size of the wound for scale. Draw a diagram of the injury's location and shape. And your documentation should always be objective. Describe what you see. A 3-inch parallel linear bruise on the left upper arm without assigning blame.
And that level of precision leads us right to the SBAR communication framework, which is so crucial for organizing all this, both for documentation and for verbal handoffs. We really have to use all four parts.
Absolutely. SBAR ensures clarity and that no critical information gets lost. S is for situation. What is the immediate concern? For example, we have client X, age 85, who had an unwitnessed fall and now has altered consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
B is for background. This is the client's age, race, relevant medical history, their baseline status. Client is normally alert, has a history of diabetes, lives with his daughter. A is for assessment. This is what you see, hear, or smell. This includes the raccoon eyes, the bruises, the nonverbal fear. Client has bruising behind the left ear, battle sign, and is currently lethargic. And R is for recommendation. What do you want the service provider to do? I recommend an immediate stat CT scan and neuro assessment in the ER. Using all four parts gives the next person the full picture fast.
This has been an incredibly detailed deep dive. We've moved from the subtle, often confusing nature of bruising, all the way through the critical signs of trauma, like spiral fractures and head injuries, and then to how we must communicate it all using SBAR.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, the knowledge of these physical signs is really only half the battle. The critical connection is the context that they appear in. Our sources note that clients who simply report being afraid of their current living situation or who are living in unsafe conditions, hoarding, infestation, they need immediate help from a healthcare professional and maybe law enforcement. This goes beyond just clinical documentation.
And this raises a really important question for you, the listener. Beyond documenting the visible wounds and the obvious red flags, how much attention are you giving to the subtle nonverbal cries for help? That nervousness, the change in behavior, or that simple, sustained look of fear that so often accompanies these physical indicators. This vigilance, recognizing the emotional and environmental context alongside the physical wounds, is often the ultimate key to initiating the intervention a client desperately needs.